From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. As America's competitive position becomes more tenuous in the world market, experts look to Japan and its culture for solutions. But that's misguided, according to journalist James Fallows, who's lived in the Far East for 3 years. On today's Fresh Air, Fallows tells us why America should identify its own strengths and use them instead of trying to copy the Japanese. Also today, I talk with media analyst Catherine Montgomery about the struggles of advocacy groups to influence the content of network television. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new album by the British singing group The Talis Scholars. And book critic John Leonard reviews Our Kind of People, Jonathan Yardley's family memoir. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. David Halberstam once described his friend and fellow journalist James Fallows as one of the most interesting voices of a young generation of political and societal reporters. Fallows was the chief speechwriter for President Carter during his first 2 years in office. When Fallows left, he wrote a controversial article called The Passionless Presidency, which was published in The Atlantic magazine, where Fallows later became Washington editor. He's also the author of National Defense, a critique of U.S. military priorities. James Fallows has been living in Malaysia and Japan for the past 3 years. Perhaps you've been following his reports in The Atlantic and on NPR's Morning Edition. His new book tries to explain American culture by contrasting it with Asian societies. Many experts have made the case that in order for the U.S. to become more competitive, we should become more like the Japanese. Fallows concludes that it's pointless to try to pretend we can become them. We should become more like us, figure out what our own cultural strengths are, and use them. More Like Us is the title of Fallows' new book. It opens with this sentence. The purpose of this book is to remind Americans of how unusual our national culture is and of why it is important that we not become a, quote, normal society.
What I mean is that certain parts of our daily life that Americans just take for granted are actually among the most unusual traits of American society, and you begin to see them clearly only when you live someplace different, including someplace as fundamentally different as Japan. I think the two things that to me seem most abnormal and most necessary about America are, first, the idea that different people from different parts of the world who have different religions and colors and everything else can come together and form one society. That sounds like a bunch of civics text pap to most people in America, I think, but it is a radical idea to most people in the rest of the world. There's virtually no Asian society that believes you can have people of different colors living together successfully in one place, and that's something that is unusual about us and good. The other thing that I think is most unusual, but yet kind of drifts into the background landscape in America, is the idea that people can do what they want with their lives, that women, for example, can have professional jobs if they want, that somebody who happens to be born into one class can at least try to be in a different class, or that people who get a certain job when they're 20 can get a different job when they're 30 if they don't like the job that much. These things all seem just almost boring to Americans, but are radical concepts and are I think, the main tools America has to work with to make itself healthy and strong.
Well, you really make the point in your book about how Japan is really a homogenous culture, both ethnically and in terms of the values that the people there share. And you say that your own modest proposal for solving America's racial problems is to make all white Americans live in Japan for a year or two. It's a quick way to learn how it feels to have your race be the most important and, on the whole, unfavorable thing about you. How have you experienced that? Do you feel like a real minority in Japan?
In many parts of the world, including Africa and Latin America and most of the rest of Asia, you're obviously different as a white person, as a white American. People can tell who you are on sight. There is something, there's an additional edge to that in Japan, I think, because of two overlapping pressures. One is the very powerful Japanese idea of racial homogeneity. I say idea rather than reality because there is some little variation in the Japanese population, but the idea is that there is one pure Japanese race. And so you're constantly aware of being on the outside of that. I'll walk around a corner in Yokohama where I live, and suddenly I'll hear from five little children's voices, "Kaijinda," which means it's an outsider, it's a foreigner. So that's that extra edge that comes from Japan's own emphasis on its homogeneity. Also, there is this sense in Japan that of judging different cultures sort of on their moral worth. And there is the growing sense in Japan that other cultures, white American culture, black culture in America and in Africa, and virtually all their cultures just aren't up to competing with Japan. And so you have this sense that, for example, if somebody from a Japanese office calls me on Saturday morning, they'll say, "Oh, I'm sorry to be disturbing you. I know you're probably not working on Saturday, but still, we are at the office, so I need to call you." So all these things pile up to kind of emphasize the differentness all the time.
Well, you know, you tell a story about how you and your sons, I think, got into a sauna in Japan and everybody got out.
One of our favorite rituals, and I have taken my sons to, is to go to the public bath, the sento, as they're called, it's a big public area. They now are segregated by sex. They used to be co-ed. But you spend about a half an hour getting these big pails of boiling hot water and pouring them over yourselves and just scrubbing every inch of your body with this very coarse soap. And then when you finally have ritually purified yourself, you step into the tub, into this very, very hot tub to get steeped for a while. The first time we did this in our neighborhood, there were about five Japanese men in the tub, and my sons, I had cleaned so that they were, it's not just they were shining, they were almost bleeding from how much I had scrubbed them. But when we got into the water, everybody got out. And I think it was a subconscious thing of just the idea of our skin touching the same water that everybody else was in. It was just too disorienting to the people. They didn't mean to offend us, but it was too much a disturbance. Now, I should say after a while, they would be in the, a few weeks later, they would get in the same tub with us. But it's an expression of an instinct.
Mm-hmm. What's this like for your children? They're in a school in Yokohama where there's around 800 students, and your sons are the only two Americans in the school, the only two
foreigners.
Foreigners, yeah.
It has been the richest and in some ways most difficult, in some ways best experience of their lives. I'm sure that their lives will always be different because of what they've been through there. In most ways, it has been very good. The school has tried hard to integrate them well. Our kids have learned a lot more Japanese than they would know otherwise. A lot of the children have been nice to them. But I think they will always know what it is like to be the outsiders, to know what you know, just all the sorts of casual snubs one bears as an outsider, what they feel like. So I hope this will make them, I hope instead of making them resentful, it will make them wiser as they get older.
Journalist James Fallows is my guest, and his new book, More Like Us, looks at American culture through the perspective of living in Asia. And he reports for the Atlantic Monthly, and also you probably hear his reports on NPR's Morning Edition. Many people have stressed to you in Japan that it's easier to manage a country where everyone shares the same values. And I think this is one of the things that you're getting to by stressing the homogeneity in Japan.
Well, it certainly is easier to manage Japan than it is to manage America. You also use the comparison that it's be easier to be governor of Utah than to be governor of New York when mm-hmm. you have a less radically different society. There are fewer disputes to work out. It's again plain from my children's experience in the schools that so much emphasis is placed from an early age on people sharing the same values, learning to cooperate. The children in schools receive individual grades, but also grades on how the whole class has done and how it has cooperated and pulled together. On the other hand, there are certain advantages that New York has over Utah, and that America has over Japan. And I think that the point I'm trying to make in this book is to recognize the areas where we are strong and can be strong. And one of those, the greatest of those, is our very diversity and ability to tolerate difference and chaos and to be more adaptable than I think the Japanese can in the long run be.
Well, in keeping with that idea, you point out how in the United States, people reinvent themselves all the time. They move from one class to another. They change professions. They change locations. They move away from their family. And then they can move back again if they want to. And this is an idea that particularly excites you, I think, living in Japan, where there isn't that sense of constant reinvention.
Your listeners may, again, have a hard time of saying, well, so what? So people get new jobs. But it is different from how, for example, Japan works. Let me give one or two illustrations. Almost every major company in Japan hires people only at one age. That is, people coming directly out of college. That is, the job you get when you're 20 or 22 is the job you have. And it also is the job you have have if you are a man. If you are a woman, it's the job you have for 3 or 4 years as an office lady, and then you go and you get married and have 2 children and don't work again except some kind of part-time work later on. We take it for granted that if you are dissatisfied when you're 30 or when you're 50, you can do something different. In many other parts of the world, you can't. When I was leaving Tokyo a couple days ago, I picked up a magazine, a very popular magazine, kind of like Parade in Japan, and the cover was 2 big Chinese characters saying Todai for Tokyo University. The contents of the magazine were the lists of all the people who'd passed the entrance exam for Tokyo University and therefore would be running Japan for the next 40 years. It is a much more static, all-or-nothing decision than we're able to make. So I think we need to appreciate the looseness that is available here.
This is a concept that has a lot of personal resonance for you, since you feel that you and your parents both went through this kind of reinvention.
In my parents' case, you know, we're all victims to a degree of our own experience. The shaping experience in my father and mother's life was when they decided to leave Philadelphia, the suburbs of Philadelphia, where they had grown up, and just start a new life in California a little while after World War II. It wasn't so much the difference between Philadelphia and California. It was the fact of they are just making up something new for themselves, and that leaving a place where they had a lot of traditions that were comfortable in some ways and confining in other ways, and going to a new place where they could just figure out new things they wanted to do. And certainly for my father, at least, it was a completely energizing and liberating experience. My mother always had more mixed emotions of missing all the comforts and tradition of Philadelphia while appreciating some of the looseness of California, too.
How does this apply, this idea of reinvention? How does it apply to keeping America more competitive in the international marketplace?
Well, it doesn't mean that next week we can improve the trade balance, or that we can have, you know, basic oxygen furnaces in the steel plant next year to deal better with the Japanese. And there are a lot of trade issues that have nothing to do with what I'm talking about. They involve saving incentives and industrial strategies in Japan and so forth. But in the long run, it seems to me that societies either work or they don't economically, depending on the cultural values they have. There are certain societies, and Japan is a leading example right now, that do a masterful job of marrying people's incentives and people's values and people's habits to the larger interests of the country. And I think America is perfectly capable of doing that. This is a very successful country on the whole, but it needs to do it in a different way. And if Americans feel that they're not stuck in certain classes, they're not discriminated against on the basis of race or sex, they do have second chances, they can do different things, then they're more likely to behave in ways that help the country economically. They're more likely to start new businesses. They're more likely to have a sense of participation where they work. They're less likely to be resentful and surly and not doing the job right. So it's not an immediate connection to these trade issues, but in the long run, I think that's how societies succeed or fail.
Your book really celebrates cultural diversity. And the kind of diversity we've gotten in the United States through constant immigration through the years of people from different cultures. A lot of people now think we should close down our immigration policies because there's so much competition with workers who are already in the States, and for other reasons as well. Where do you stand on immigration?
I think immigration is America's greatest strategic advantage in the long run over any other country, and it's something we'd be very foolish not to welcome. Let me mention this in different ways. I'm always coming across people in Hong Kong, in Indonesia, in Taiwan, not so often in Japan, but people who for one reason or another are not able in their own home society to use their ambitions. They're in the wrong class in Indonesia, so they can't start a factory there. They didn't go to the right university in Korea. But and America is to these people the place where they can use their ambitions. And this has historically been a great advantage to us, to be the place where people could come and try their best and make things better for everybody. It's also I'm well aware of the frictions that immigration causes, the sense of competition, the sense of differentness, the sense of that the center can't hold and things are flying apart. But it's worth recognizing that That's always been the case. And at the turn of the century, when my grandmother came from Germany, a lot of other people arrived, the sense of competition and differentness was much more acute than it is now. There were articles written then, including in the Atlantic Monthly, about how Italians and Poles, you know, they weren't really people. They were so different from the good Anglo-Saxon stock, they could never be absorbed. So we've been through worse disruptions than this before and are stronger for it, and I think we'll be stronger for the current immigrant disruption.
I'm sure some of our listeners are thinking that as much as we may talk about the ability to reinvent yourself in the United States, that this is almost impossible for people who are in the underclass, who are discriminated against, who can't find employment, can't find housing.
Well, it's certainly true that America's great problem at the moment is the largely black underclass coming from America's great sin in history, which was slavery. And I would use this as an example of how destructive it is to America if people think they can't change and think that they can't succeed. Of the many factors that keep the underclass stuck in place, I think one of the most powerful is this idea that there's no point really in trying in anything except perhaps sports or narcotic sales because you can't succeed anyplace else. And people who believe they're going to fail do fail. It's interesting to note that black-skinned immigrants from Western Africa and from the Caribbean who suffer the same kind of racial prejudice as people in the black underclass do statistically succeed very well, just like other immigrants in America. So there are barriers of discrimination, but some people are able to overcome them. And so the problem, I think, with the underclass is not simply the discrimination that's helped create it, but now this defeated culture that keeps people where they are.
Most experts who have compared the United States and Japan have looked at the two countries in terms of economics and politics. Your book examines these two countries culturally. What do you think are do you think are some of the things that you get from looking at the two countries culturally instead of just through economics and politics?
I think you see two really different ideas of what the final purpose of life is. As best I can understand the satisfaction of life and the final purpose of life in Japan, it is to perform your duty admirably within some network of human connections. It's to do your duty within your family, to your parents and your children. It's to do your duty within your organization. And that is what morality is finally about. It's what human satisfaction is finally about. That's different from the U.S., where we have some idea of life's fulfillment being as an individual figuring out what is most important for you, although we, of course, believe in duty, et cetera. But these biases are different, and they make for different strengths and weaknesses. I think very few Americans would be satisfied as immigrants to Japan because they would feel there's something lacking in life, that there's not enough to satisfy us just in this performance of duty. It makes for some things that are extremely admirable in Japan, notably the sense that everybody is doing his best almost all the time. That's the thing I constantly admire in Japan.
Okay, well, I want to talk with you more about your life in Japan over the past 3 years. But first, we're going to take a short break, and my guest is journalist James Fallows. We're discussing the subject of his new book, More Like Us, and it's really comparing the United States with Asian cultures. And we'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest James Fallows has been reporting from Asia for the past 3 years for The Atlantic Magazine and for National Public Radio. In his new book, More Like Us, he reexamines the United States by comparing it to societies in Asia. We were just talking about how you've looked at Asia and the United States culturally instead of strictly economically. So can you just sum up for us some of the different conclusions you think you've reached by looking at it this way?
The main point I'm trying to make about America is that its virtues are unusual in the world. It's the probably the only society in the world that really thrives on disorder, that can tolerate the disorder of people moving around, of foreigners coming in, of people deciding to change their lives once they get started. And that instead of being disturbed by this, we should recognize it as our great gift and do things to make it as possible as we can. I spend about the last half of the book talking about factors that make that less possible, the various sorts of class rigidities that make it harder for Americans to feel this mobility. So that's my point, to recognize what makes us what we are.
Why did you decide to go to Asia and set up shop there and write for American magazines?
There were two reasons. One is I'd been living in Washington for a number of years before then and wanted to live someplace besides Washington. The other was that I had been curious about Asia, and like everybody else in the U.S., I heard about the rising Pacific Rim economies, but I'd never seen them. The thing I like most about journalism is the ability to go out and see something for yourself, and then you can develop your own opinions about it. So I wanted to see what it was like. So with my family, we went to Japan first for about 6 months, then we lived in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia for about 2 years, and now back in Japan since last summer.
I enjoy your reports for National Public Radio. Where do you file from? What studio do you record in?
the famous bathroom studio of my own house.
Oh no, really?
Yes, because it's my house is so small, like many others in Japan, that if I did any place except the bathroom, you'd hear constantly the chants of all the vendors who drive up and down the streets and selling fried potatoes with this or baked potatoes with the yakiimo call. So I go into the bathroom and hang up various towels and things over the door and sit in the bathtub with a recorder on my my lap. That's my studio.
It seems that shopping and buying ordinary goods takes on a completely different meaning for you as an American in Japan. For instance, you tell a great story about how the whole family wanted slippers to wear in the house, so you decided to order from L.L. Bean, and for the family of four, the slippers came out to $108, but you had to pay a lot more than that.
Yeah, the tariff, I think, was another $250 or something like that. About it was 154% tariff, and this is... I think something that for foreigners living in Japan, they most want to convince people in America about. When you hear the stories about high prices in Japan, you think, oh, well, this is just because of the exchange rate. These people are whining. The real point is that everything in Japan for the Japanese has an exorbitant cost because of the various protections built into the economy and its orientation towards export rather than consumer welfare. The intriguing thing is that nobody complains. Nobody complains that there's 154% tariff on shoes or leather goods. Nobody complains that rice costs eight times as much as it does in the U.S., literally eight times as much. Nobody complains, most mysteriously of all, that every single Japanese-made product I have ever seen costs more in Japan than it does in New York or Los Angeles or any place where it's exported. So this is the moral meaning of shopping. There's some real economic distortion that it reveals, but it seems intriguing only to foreigners, not to the Japanese themselves.
So you think that the Japanese don't complain about the higher prices because they think it's finally good for the country?
I think so. I think that there is a more tribal sense of the welfare of the society that they don't want to hurt their producers, their big companies, and so they just don't complain about the prices they have to pay.
Have you been watching your American money decrease in value over the years?
It is just too painful even to think about, and so when I come back to the U.S., I am startled by how cheap everything is. I can hardly believe it, but my wife and I find the only way we can remain sane in Japan is not to convert things into dollars. If you think that something costs if I think in a hotel I'm paying 1,000 yen for a beer, I'm used to that. If I think that means $8, then I get depressed.
You know what I'd like to know? In dealing with the cultures of Japan and the United States, how do you deal with cultural traits without reducing them to stereotypes? I think it's a very tough thing to do.
It is very tough, and I'm probably guilty of well, there's a risk for me and for anybody else who writes about Japan in being guilty of that, because compared to most other cultures, Japan is more homogeneous than most other places. And there are certain things that sound like stereotypes that are in fact true. So it is a very difficult problem in talking about Japan in particular, and I don't know how to overcome it.
Mm-hmm. One of the stops you've made in the years that you've been living in Asia is Vietnam.
Yes.
And Vietnam is a subject you've written about, and you have a now famous piece about why you think there should be a universal draft. You weren't drafted. You were of a privileged class, and you had ways of getting out of it between a student deferment and knowing how to fast so that you'd be underweight. And as you pointed out in the article, people who were less educated and less financially secure wouldn't even know the tricks of getting out of the draft. So you recommended a universal draft so that everybody would be in the same boat, and if a policy was bad, all the parents and all the people of draft age would be fighting it together. Did your opinions undergo any change after visiting Vietnam?
There was one enormous surprise of going to Vietnam, and made me wish that in addition to white Americans living in Japan, that all Americans could go to Vietnam, because in Vietnam there is no sign that the U.S. was ever there. You find very few English speakers, almost no war materiel, very little interest in what it was like when the Americans were there, because what the Vietnamese refer to as the American War was about an eight-year period preceded by the French War and followed by the Chinese War and the Cambodian War, and it is basically not important to them anymore. And it's not important to very many people in Asia anymore. Their refugees are still important, but nobody talks about the rights or wrongs of Vietnam that I've come across in the Philippines or Korea or Japan. And so it made me realize that the only place where the Vietnam War is still important, still an emotional issue, is in America, not in Asia. And I think that there's a kind of lancing of the boil effect that comes from seeing that and seeing that it is old and uninteresting history in Vietnam itself.
And has that made you think less about the war?
Well, it's made me, I guess, wish that in America we could do whatever it takes to have the same finished business approach to it. That, you know, resolve the maybe we won't ever be able to resolve all the emotional damage that the war did, but it might be easier if we realize that it's our own internal problem. It doesn't matter to other people.
How long are you going to stay in Asia?
I believe for until probably late this year, maybe September or so. I would selfishly, I would like to stay longer than that. I will probably travel back and forth, but I think the imperatives of my children mean that it would be rough on them to keep them in Japanese school or away from what they are beginning to think of as their lost homeland for much longer.
Why would you want to stay?
It is the most interesting thing I've ever done. Where every day you see something that you didn't know about the day before, and so it's a period of my life I'll be very sad to see come to a close.
What do you think you're going to write about when you come back to the States?
I think I will be much less interested in politics in Washington and much more interested in sort of these large cultural currents that make the U.S. go.
And why?
And why will it be interesting? The Washington politics itself seems more parochial and kind of a toy town than not that different from politics in Jakarta, except in its consequences. And the social traits of you know, how the races get along together, of what makes people feel happy or sad, that seems more interesting because it begins to seem to me more unusual about America.
Well, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your observations with us. Thank you very much for your time.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks.
My guest has been James Fallows, and his new book, More Like Us, is published by Houghton Mifflin. You can also read his reports from Asia in the Atlantic magazine and hear his reports on NPR's Morning Edition. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time on Fresh Air, Lyndon LaRouche and the New American Fascism. Author Dennis King's new book charts LaRouche's move from the far left to the far right, how he built a powerful political machine in this country, and the corruption that led him to prison. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In 1972, when the sitcom Maude dealt with the issue of abortion, religious groups besieged the network. That incident was a turning point in the ongoing confrontation between advocacy groups and network TV. On today's Fresh Air, media analyst Catherine Montgomery examines how advocacy groups try to influence TV programming and how TV executives respond. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new album by the British singing group The Tallis Scholars, featuring the work of composer William Cornish. And book critic John Leonard reviews Our Kind of People, Jonathan Yardley's family memoir. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Federal officials today announced the indictment of junk bond specialist Michael Milken on 98 counts of racketeering and securities fraud. Milken propelled the investment firm of Drexel Burnham Lambert into the top ranks of Wall Street brokerage houses with his questionable use of debt to finance corporate takeovers. Milken says he is innocent and in a statement said that he is eager to present his case in court. If convicted, Milken could be sentenced to up to 520 years in jail. He and two co-defendants could be forced to return up to $1.8 billion in allegedly illegal profits. The Justice Department today announced that it has broken a $1 billion money laundering ring that has direct links to Colombian-based Medellin drug cartel. NPR's Julie McCarthy has details.
Attorney General Richard Thornburg announced today that in the course of the two-year investigation, 127 people had been charged, a half a ton of cocaine had been seized, and $45 million in assets had been confiscated. Thornburg described the money laundering scheme as incredibly complicated and called the investigation the largest of its kind ever conducted by federal authorities.
I think it's fair to describe this operation as a very hostile takeover of a major money laundering operation, and one that we hope we can replicate very soon and very often.
Two banks, one in Panama and one in Colombia, were also indicted for their alleged role in the $1 billion money laundering scheme. Today, Thornburg praised the cooperation of the Panamanian and Colombian law enforcement agencies. There was no evidence, he said, of any involvement in the laundering operation by government officials in the two countries. I'm Julie McCarthy in Washington.
Federal officials surveying that oil spill in Alaska have reportedly told President Bush there is good cooperation among authorities involved in the cleanup, but state officials are giving up trying to remove the spreading oil and are concentrating their efforts on defending shorelines and fishing grounds. The mayor of Valdez, where the spill occurred, says it's clear to him that his constituents are facing the destruction of their way of life. British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher continued her African tour today, holding talks with both the leaders of Zimbabwe and Mozambique. Julie Fredericks reports from Harare.
Prime Minister Thatcher flew from the Zimbabwean capital to a remote military camp on the eastern border with Mozambique this afternoon, where British and Zimbabwean officers are training Mozambican troops to fight anti-Mozambican government forces. Thatcher held joint talks with Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe and Mozambique's Joaquim Chissano, and for the first time, she described the Renamo rebels as terrorists. She promised to step up British military assistance in this war that is claiming not only Mozambican, but also Zimbabwean victims. On the subject of sanctions against neighboring South Africa, the British Prime Minister argued that Pretoria should not be pressed further when negotiations for the independence of Namibia were going so well. The African leaders downplayed their demand for greater Western pressure on South Africa, preferring rather to encourage Thatcher's backing for their war on a rebel force that they see as supported by South Africa. For National Public Radio, this is Julie Fredericks in Harare.
The leader of Muslims in Belgium and his deputy were shot to death today in the Brussels mosque. Imam Abdullah al-Adal had received death threats in the weeks following his comments on the Salman Rushdie novel, The Satanic Verses. In a televised interview, Adal agreed with Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini that the book is blasphemous, but he suggested Khomeini should not have pronounced a death sentence against Rushdie. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 6 points to close at 2281.52. Advances led declines on volume of 144 million shares. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The Talas Scholars is a group of 10 British singers who specialize in unaccompanied Renaissance choral music. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says their 1988 American tour was one of the musical highlights of the year. This weekend, the Talas Scholars begin another American tour. Lloyd has a review of their recent album of music by British composer William Cornish.
William Cornish was a complex and multi-talented figure. He was a musician and choral director who entered the royal household of Henry VII about the time Columbus discovered America. After Henry VIII took the throne in 1509, Cornish was named Master of the Children of the Chapel Royal, one of the most prestigious positions at court. He was in charge of all the music for court banquets, pageants, masks, and plays. Cornish was born a century before Shakespeare, and like Shakespeare, was a poet, actor, and dramatist. None of his dramatic work survives, but there's a poem he wrote during a short prison sentence called A Treatise Between Truth and Information, in which he denies the charges against him, whatever they may have been. He seems to have been a favorite of Henry VIII and a friend of the poet John Skelton. One of the most moving selections on the new album of Cornish's music by the Talas Scholars has lyrics that imitate Skelton's tumbling rhymes. It's in the voice of Christ on the cross, and it begins, "Woefully arrayed, my blood, man, for thee ran. It may not be nayed." Woefully Arrayed also has the most shocking harmonic twist when Christ exclaims, "Thus naked am I nailed." Not much of Cornish's music survives either. Peter Phillips, the director of the Talas Scholars, says that this album contains all the sacred music by Cornish that can be reconstructed. This includes Woefully Arrayed in English and five pieces in Latin, ranging from the spiraling vocal complexity of his Salve Regina, Stabat Mater, and Magnificat to the touching simplicity of his Ave Maria. He seemed to love to show off the high voices of his choir boys. The Talas Scholars use two women to sing the treble parts, and they make a particularly glorious effect, as in this passage from the Salve Regina. Cornish also wrote secular music, and the most haunting selection on this album is called Ah, Robin. It seems to be a dialogue between two friends. One of them is lucky in love and asks the other, Robin, to tell him of his beloved. But Robin's beloved is unkind. She refuses him because she loves another more. This William Cornish album is as beautifully produced and sung as all the other Tallis Scholars albums. I've lost count of how many there are now. The ones I've heard are so fine that when I heard the group in person for the first time last year, I was actually slightly disappointed. But it's also reassuring to discover that they are their own toughest competition.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. The Tallis Scholars 1989 American Tour begins Friday in Denver. They'll also perform in St. Louis, Chicago, St. Paul, New York, Boston, and Atlanta. This is Fresh Air. Gay, feminist, religious, and parents groups have all tried to influence the content of entertainment programming on network television. Catherine Montgomery, in her new book, Target Prime Time, explores the impact of such advocacy groups on primetime television. Just a couple of weeks ago, the protest of a Michigan woman against adult material on the show Married with Children made front page news. Her protest took the form of a letter-writing campaign to the show's sponsors. Several sponsors canceled commercials, and Coca-Cola said they would review their method for evaluating which programs they air their commercials on. Montgomery says the deregulation climate of the 80s may have contributed to the network's own relaxation of some of their monitoring procedures. Standards and practices departments have been cut. Some of the pressure groups on the left and the right that made inroads during the 70s found themselves shut out in the 80s. But to get an idea of the larger picture, Montgomery says it's important to examine the advocacy groups that early on figured out how television operated and how to keep the pressure on.
One of the more successful groups, at least for the period of time in the middle to late 70s, were the gay activists, who, after a few difficult efforts to try to get the attention of network television over some TV programs like Marcus Welby, which linked gays with child molestation, actually set up an operation where they talked to network people on a regular basis and insisted on being consulted on the portrayal of gays. And it's quite an interesting story.
Can you give us a shorthand version of how they did it? Most people think of gay groups as being disenfranchised. And to be able to influence the television networks, well, that really takes clout.
Well, it does. First of all, it takes understanding the business, and some of the people who were involved in it knew a little bit about the industry to begin with. They'd worked in affiliated, one had worked for Variety, and others had knew people within the industry and understood a little bit about it. But then they set out to understand it very well. They also took advantage of the fact that there were a number of gay people working within the television industry who may or may not have been known to be gay, and were able to use those people to give them inside information about what was going on with particular programs.
Have the tactics been different for instance, gay groups and feminist groups than they've been for, say, moral majority type groups?
Absolutely.
What's the difference?
Well, first of all, gay groups, black groups, women's groups have been interested in the portrayals of their own constituencies, of particular segments of the population. And therefore, they have a more limited set of concerns in a way. I mean, for example, the gay activists were concerned about the way they were portrayed in certain programs, but they weren't looking across the board at all programming. The moral majority has taken a much broader look at programming and has, in fact, I think, had a much larger agenda in terms of trying to change the value system in television and make it much more conservative and conventional than it had been. They certainly reacted in the late 70s and early 1980s to the changes in social mores as they were being reflected in television, and saw television as an important battleground to try to change all of these things, that is, to impose a moral code on the programming. And because of that, their tactics were not the kinds of targeted tactics to talk to producers and writers or network people on a regular basis about the way certain issues were treated. What they did instead was to launch a campaign to target advertisers.
Why do you think groups from the religious right have targeted sponsors instead of working behind the scenes with the networks?
Well, first of all, I know that what I see is that they can see that what they want television to do, that is to, across the board, not deal with sexual issues, to change the morals and so forth, it's not necessarily, the industry's not necessarily going to be very receptive to. If you compare them, for example, to gays or women who might be able to approach the networks and say, look, here's what we're concerned with. We don't think the images have been very positive. We have some very concrete suggestions for how you might change them. That's something that's negotiable. That's something that can be worked out, and there will be struggles over it, and there have been, as I've described in my book. But in the case of the religious right, there's such a much broader agenda that I think the leaders know network television is not going to be very receptive to them, and perhaps rightly so, because they want to, in a way, act as censors to all of the programming. But they do know, however, that advertisers are a kind of vulnerable pressure point, because advertisers are very sensitive to people's reaction to them, and they're very concerned about losing money.
You compare two different case studies in your book. This is a very interesting comparison between how an episode of Maude was handled in 1972, an episode in which Maude gets an abortion, and an episode in 1985 of Cagney and Lacey, in which they have to confront anti-abortion picketers at a clinic. What's the most telling thing in the comparison between these two shows, and what controversy meant to the networks?
Maude was broadcast, those episodes were broadcast in the fall of 1972 during a season when there was an upsurge in controversial programming, which had begun with All in the Family. And the program actually had Maude get pregnant at the age of 47 and have an abortion. There was a clear discussion of abortion, and it was talked about quite openly. In fact, Maude's daughter referred to it as being as easy as going to the dentist. There was a huge protest from the Catholic Church, who felt it was inappropriate for Maude to be talking about something like that during prime time and during a comedy program, and who felt it was one-sided. It was a really very troubling incident for network television, and one of those incidents that had an impact, a lasting impact. Abortion wasn't even dealt with for a number of years because it was such a touchy subject and because it had elicited such a huge outcry. What happened and what began to happen over time, however, is that because the networks wanted controversial material in their programs in order to draw audiences, they had to find ways to present that material that would deflect criticism in a kind of preemptive way, that is, that would keep these kinds of disruptive protests from happening, which had resulted in all the sponsors withdrawing from the Maude episode the second time it was shown, and a number of affiliates from not carrying the show. So by the time you get to 1985 with a show like Cagney and Lacey, which decides to deal with the abortion issue, there are policies in place. And the one that's most important here is a policy of balance. And I'm sure everybody knows it when they see it, because it permeates entertainment television programming. And so when the Cagney and Lacey episode was run, there was a very, very careful attempt made to make sure that the arguments in opposition to choice were articulated and done so very, very carefully within the program. And so written into the show was a pro-life activist who was purposefully presented as a very positive, articulate person and who could articulate this position effectively. And that was the way of creating balance. Now, the show did elicit some protests, but part of those protests were actually sort of stirred up by the producer who wanted more visibility for the show. And often these protests do help draw more attention to the program.
Do Do you feel reassured that there are advocacy groups who are pressuring the networks to change the content of their programming, to change the way people are represented in programs? Does this inspire confidence on your part? Does
it inspire confidence in whom?
In you as a viewer. In you as a viewer. I mean, are you glad that there are a lot of
advocacy groups? In a way, yes, I am. I mean, I think that the viewers need to be active and need to be involved in television. Television is a very powerful and pervasive medium. It has a presence in people's lives that is unprecedented. And it's understandable why organizations see programming as something to be involved with and why they would react and why they would do something about things the way things are presented. So I'm glad that viewers are active. I wouldn't expect these organizations, these organized viewers, to be totally passive. And I think in a way it works as a kind of feedback, as the networks referred to it at one point, for the networks. That is, they know how people and groups are reacting. They also learn. The other thing is, groups have worked as consultants and have actually negotiated with the networks and given them information and helped them know better how to portray a given group of people or how to deal with a certain issue, and that I think that's good.
Catherine, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Catherine Montgomery teaches film and television at UCLA. Her new book, Target Prime Time, is published by Oxford University Press.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played
songs that made the hit parade.
Guys like us, we had it made.
Those were the days. And you knew where you were then.
Girls were girls and men were men.
This is Fresh Air. Let's check in with Robert Siegel and see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, we're following reported shifts in U.S. policy toward the Nicaraguan Contras, some modifications there reported. Also, we talk with an expert on Yugoslavia about what the rioting in Kosovo province by ethnic Albanians is likely to mean for that country. And Daniel Pinkwater, part three on the making of an artist. You've been following?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, today... we'll call it The Forging of an Artist. Pinkwater, on summer break from college, works in a foundry, the closest he has gotten to actually the things that sculptors use, and discovers that he does not like hot metal.
Okay, thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Book critic and columnist Jonathan Yardley has written a memoir about his family called Our Kind of People. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Jonathan Yardley has given us a great deal. Maybe it's ungrateful to want more. But more is what I want from the Pulitzer-winning book critic and grouchy columnist for The Washington Post. He seeks in this diamond-hard memoir to explain and celebrate his parents and the WASP America from which they came. Yardleys, Woolseys, Gregorys, and Ingersolls. Men of measured merriment, slow-burning women, big houses and private schools, a vanished republic of honor and rectitude. He reads aloud to us from a treasure trove of family papers, as if from Trollope. He's proud of ministers, teachers, lawyers, and traveling salesmen who had, and I quote, through the lives of their own ancestors, intimate knowledge of the traditions and convictions out of which the nation had been shaped. He resents their caricature, almost as much as he deplores the pestilence of the modern world of industrial polluters and television. If our kind of people isn't innocent of booze, bankruptcy, mental illness, suicide, and murder, not to mention a relative who choked one Christmas on his roast beef, it does insist, for the most part, on happy households, happy childhoods. If Jonathan's father, Bill, a headmaster all his life at schools for privileged girls, thought, and I quote again, that all Jews were Shylocks and Negroes fit only for servitude, he voted anyway in 1932 for the socialist Norman Thomas, and he would at the end of the 1960s permit the enrollment of two black students in Virginia's Chatham Hall. Jonathan's feelings about his father, with his love of, quote, all things military so long as they did not require his enlistment, and his unerring instinct for flattering older people, are a lot more mixed than his feelings about his mother. Bill, after all, studied for the ministry in mid-career, not because he'd heard the call, but because he needed a job and liked to dress up. But the son won't Oedipalize. Young John was sent by a fancy private school to a psychiatrist, quote, an odious little man who managed in the space of less than an hour to instill in me a prejudice against his profession that deepens and ripens with each passing year. His father, he tells us, became exactly who he wanted to be, quote, as most people do, he had found his niche in the world. I don't for a minute believe that most people find their niche in the world. Most people are sentenced to their niche in a world that's futile, but I'm only half wasp. What I want more of from a critic of Yardley's persuasive powers is a leap into the literature. What's become of the wasp since Marquand and James Gould Cousins? What does his sour complacency look like in the novels of fellow wasps like Cheever and Welty, Updike and Vidal, Didion and Styron, Auchincloss and Reynolds Price? What does this literature suggest about wasps and the political life of a suffering republic? Whatever became of the moral passion of the first abolitionists, all of them wasps? The very Protestantism of Yardley's ancestors was a radical idea, a profound criticism of the way the world worked. Jonathan Yardley himself was named for, and on both sides of his family descends from, Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards, the Puritan scourge, who said that God holds us over the fire of his wrath as if we were not wasps, but loathsome spiders.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Jonathan Yardley's memoir, Our Kind of People. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Entezake Shange is best known as the author of For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide, When the Rainbow is Enough. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about her new music theater piece, Betsy Brown. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Madonna's new album, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new teen movie, Heathers. Stephen says if you've become sick of the teen genre, this movie could change your mind. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Peter Murdoch. Chris Burgeon directs the show. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.